passport photo. Amateur Traveler, episode 742. Today, the Amateur Traveler, we take a hike across England and across English history as we look at Roman ruins and English countryside when we hike Hadrian's Wall. Welcome to the Amateur Traveler. I'm your host, Chris Christensen. Let's talk about hiking Hadrian's Wall. I'd like to welcome back to the show Larissa Milne, who's come to talk to us about hiking Hadrian's Wall. Larissa, welcome back to Amateur Traveler.
Hi, Chris. Nice to be back.
And I say welcome back. Larissa has been on twice before, once talking about Buffalo, New York, and once talking about her hometown of Philadelphia, or former hometown since she's now nomadic. Larissa, where is Hadrian's Wall and why are we talking about it?
Okay. Hadrian's Wall is a wall that is located in the north of England, just about along England's border with Scotland, not quite exactly on the border, but it is a wall that was built by the Roman Emperor Hadrian in 122 AD, and it's located right along just about the narrowest part of the island that makes up England, Scotland, and Wales. There's a spot there in northern England where the island looks like it kind of pinches together, and Hadrian, the emperor, built that wall there to mark the northernmost barrier of the Roman Empire. And what it now is, almost 2,000 years later, many parts of the wall still exist, and there is a British National Trail that goes along it that essentially spans the width of the country at that point.
Excellent. And why should someone hike Hadrian's Wall?
Well, that's kind of what my husband wondered.
I wondered who his idea was. Okay.
Well, ironically, it was his idea, although he doesn't remember that. But the reason that it's of interest and was certainly of interest to me is because of the fact that it was built in Roman times. It's a fantastic Roman ruin, first of all, that again stretches for many miles up there in the northern part of England. But it also was a place where there was a lot of Roman settlements because it was kind of the northern barrier of the empire. So there are a lot of settlements and forts kind of scattered in the general vicinity. So anybody who's interested in Roman history and Roman ruins will find it a great destination to explore all of that. And I'm somebody who likes to walk, although the whole idea of doing, I'm not a big backpacker, overnight camping type of person where I want to do wilderness walks. Mm-hmm. The Pacific Crest Trail, such as was epitomized in Wild and things like that, doesn't really hold a whole lot of fascination for me. I read the book. I love the story. But for me, if I'm going to go walking, I want to see stuff while I'm walking. Mm-hmm. And this seemed to meet that need, that there would be things I could see along the way while I completed a walk. And the other thing that really appealed to me about this was this whole idea of going virtually from one side of the country to the other. The walk itself is 84 miles long. So it's not that long in the grand scheme of these long treks, mm-hmm. but it was long enough for me. And I just liked the idea of doing that, kind of going, starting at almost sea to shining sea, or not quite, but just about. And that really appealed to me with the idea that there would be things to see along the way. And I was at a point in my life where I was approaching my 60th birthday, and I wanted to do something sort of monumental that involved travel. And I really wasn't sure what I wanted to do, but this is something that had been in the back of my mind for a couple of years, that it was a challenge I wanted to take on. And in a moment, he would come to regret. My husband said, "You should do the Hadrian's Wall walk for your 60th birthday." And it kind of really clicked for me. I thought, this is going to hit on all cylinders. It's going to be a walk. It's going to be something I can accomplish, definitely outside of my comfort zone, because I hadn't really done anything like this to that extent, an 84-mile walk before. Plus, I would get to see all these Roman ruins. And dutiful guy that he was, he agreed to come along. So that was kind of the motivation behind all of it.
Now, to be fair, he is a bit of a history buff also.
Oh, yeah. That was no problem for him. His thought was, could I just take taxis or rent a car and drive to all the sites and just meet you there and then catch you 3 or 4 miles down the way? But to his credit, he went along and did it. It really was a fantastic trip. And I think that one of the things that I learned as I was investigating it, which is why I continue to do even more research, was that many people who take on this trek or walk are people who are serial walkers or trekkers, sure, and their goal is to kind of complete it as quickly as they possibly can, which was more or less the antithesis of what I wanted to do. Because I said, if I'm motoring through and doing 18 or 20 miles a day, that means I'm not taking time, right, yeah, exactly, to see anything. So I did a lot of research and made the decision that, along with Michael, my husband, that we were going to take it a little bit more slowly and stop a few times along the way. We took 8 days to actually walk the trail. So mm-hmm. we averaged about 10 miles a day, a little bit more. But within there, we took 2 days that where we did not go along the walk. We didn't necessarily call them, I wouldn't call them rest days per se, because we did still do a fair amount of walking and exploring.
Oh, got it. Okay.
Somewhere along the way. But it was more to see some of the sites that were there that we felt demanded more attention than just a 10 or 20 minute walk through. So we took 10 full days to do this from one end to the other.
Well, that's one of the reasons why this is actually on my bucket list, is that I can picture having 10 days to do this. Mm-hmm. And so that's actually how this show came about, as I was recently updating my bucket list, which is linked on amateurtraveler.com, and trying to see if I had been to more things that I'd seen, or do I want to take some things off, actually. Mm-hmm. And I think I actually did edit it a bit. But I saw this and thought, oh, we should do an episode on hiking Hadrian's Wall. And then I thought, I know someone who's done that. Now, you were not doing a lot of rough camping along your way, as you mentioned.
Nope. In fact, we were not doing camping at all. Another thing that appealed to me.
And that's the other reason why this is on my list, is I think I might be able to talk my wife into doing it when she gets over a foot injury, at least. But the logistics then get a little more complicated, because you weren't just setting up your tent. You were booking ahead. I assume you had all your reservations booked before you started?
Yes. So that's one of the things that also appealed about this, partly because it's in England, first of all. There's not much of England that's the rough wilds anyway. Mm-hmm. So there are, you know, little villages along the way and what have you. But so what we did is we booked the entire trip in advance, and we did stay at bed and breakfast every night. And because we booked through one of several booking companies that are available, and I'll be happy to share the one we used.
Sure, please do.
But what they do is they book you into a series of bed and breakfasts along the way, and then part of the fee that you pay covers porterage of your luggage.
Right.
So every morning you leave your suitcase packed at the door of the B&B. You take your little day pack that's got water and some snacks and a few other necessities for the day, and then you walk to the next wherever you're going to be that night. And when you get there, your luggage is waiting for you, which is, I thought, was a really nice feature, because then you didn't really have to worry about dragging all your stuff with you, which right. to me, again,
it's a hike, not a backpack trip.
Yes, exactly. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So to that end, yeah, I would recommend using a company to book a trip, simply because these are little old villages. They're charming and everything, but these are tiny little B&Bs, in some cases youth hostels, what have you. There's not a lot of lodging available, and it can get booked up. So all the prevailing information I had read suggested that you work with one of these booking companies that will arrange it for you, because first, they know all of sure. the places, and second, they've got good relationships and they can get those reservations done for you. So yeah, we did have everything booked ahead.
And you worked with who to do that?
We worked with a company called Hadrian's Wall Limited.
Okay.
And their website, I can give it to you if you'd like.
I can find it.
Okay. And one of the reasons I chose them, there are a lot of different companies that'll do walking holidays, and there are some that have them all over Europe or all over the world. And all of them, I think, are probably pretty reputable, or most of them. The reason I chose this particular one, obviously from their name, this is a focus of theirs. But the other thing that I liked about what they offered, they're very customizable. Mm-hmm. They have a couple of suggested itineraries. If you want to do the walk in 4 days, or you want to do the walk in 6 days, or you only want to do part of the walk, they have a couple of preset, quote, self-guided tours if you want. But the other thing that I liked about them is they had multiple budget levels that you could book with them, so that they had something that was, quote, five-star, which would mean not super, super. It's not like you were staying in palaces or anything, but that would be double occupancy at a bed and breakfast, private bath, nice accommodations, and then all the way down to kind of this one-star level, which would be staying in a youth hostel. But for some people, that might be appropriate and might be all they want, and kind of in everywhere in between. So basically, depending on your budget level, what you're essentially paying is you're paying the room rate, and then you're paying a fee for them to porter the luggage for you. So it wasn't much more expensive than if you had just booked the rooms all on your own. So I thought it was really worth it. And then the other thing about them that might be of interest to some of your readers, if you are somebody who wants to do camping, they actually will arrange camping excursions as well,
right,
where they will even set up your tent for you and porter your luggage. So then all you have to do is get to the next camp location at the end of the day. That's a very budget-oriented kind of trip. And if you're somebody who likes camping and you're doing this summer, that's a great way to do it, again, without having to backpack your way through it.
Excellent.
So that was, that's the reason I chose them.
And then in terms of the wall itself, I want to set some expectations of what it is and what it isn't. We're not talking about the Great Wall of China, where this was an impenetrable barrier for the Scots to come down from the north here.
That's correct.
It wouldn't come up to my shoulder height, I think, in most places.
In some spots, it will. But for the most part, when it was built, it was about 15 feet tall and probably about
3
feet deep. But not like the Great Wall of China, where you can't walk on top of it. It's not that big. And it was really designed to be a border, not necessarily something to keep people out.
Well, and to control trade, basically, so you could tax things coming in and out, because you couldn't get a cart over it. And so the carts would come through the forts and the gates and be taxed appropriately.
Yeah, exactly. And they were called, it's roughly a mile. It's about 5,000 feet. They would have something called a mile castle. Mm-hmm. That was basically like a border entry. You can see the outline of some of them still when you're walking along the path. But they were roughly, I think it was considered 5,000 paces. And that was considered a Roman mile. So they had them all along the way, and then scattered along every so many mile castles, there were actual forts that held garrisons of Roman soldiers who were manning these walls. And those were a little taller when they were built. They're all, again, down now, about, depending on where they are, some of them are 2 feet high, some of them are still 6 or 8 feet high, or crumbling bits of wall. But those were actual structures that were probably about 20 feet high when they had been built. But you see them as you're walking. It's actually kind of cool. You're walking along, you're like, oh, we should be coming up to another mile castle soon. You get kind of proficient in what you're going to be looking at as far as the architecture.
Well, let's talk about the trek itself. You went from, I think you went from west to east, but I'm doing this from memory.
Yep, good memory. Yeah, and that would be, I think, if I had one bit of advice for anybody, if they asked me what's the one key thing to do, I would say walk from west to east when you're taking this walk. You can go either way. Mm-hmm. And for some reason, the earliest guidebooks had outlined the walk going from east to west. And so that tended to be the most popular way that most people did it. But whenever you speak to anybody who's from the area, and I remember speaking to the people who owned this walking company that I used to book my trek, and they booked thousands of walkers and everything, and they said, well, we don't want to tell you what to do, but if we were doing it, we would go from west to east. The main reason for that is really the prevailing winds. Oh. You're walking along some pretty craggy spots, particularly toward the center of the walk, and it's kind of high up. It's pretty windy, and when you're kind of going up and down these undulating hills, it can get cold, but it's also challenging. You're getting kind of tired because it's not a lot of height at any one time, but it's a lot of up and down. And that wind is pretty strong. And there were definitely times when I felt like the wind was actually guiding me along. And you're 8 or 9 miles into a 12-mile day, and you've got that just little bit of wind kind of helping to push you along. It's really helpful. Plus, the other thing is when you turn around, it really feels like you're fighting against the wind. There were a few times during the walk when we turned around just to see what it was like, or even just take some photos or make a brief video on our phone or something. And it was really a strong wind, and it would have been a real deterrent or just make it that much more difficult to do. So that is why we chose to go from west to east, and I'm glad we did.
And what did you see?
Oh, well, we started, basically what you see is you see lots and lots of English countryside, a lot of sheep, a lot of things that sheep leave in a field, which you have to dodge pretty carefully, and walk through a lot of villages. And then I would say that the walk or the path is divided up almost into thirds.
Okay.
And the central third, 25 to 30 miles in the center, is where you're going to find most of the Roman ruins and activity. And the reason for that is because the terrain is higher and hillier in the center. On either side, the first third and the third third, if you will, the terrain kind of slopes back down. You're getting more towards sea level, so it's a little bit flatter. And those are the areas that got settled over the last 2,000 years or so. So there's less to see there. And over the course of time, the stones that had been used in the wall, it effectively became like a Home Depot.
Sure, yeah.
600 AD or something, the wall had long since been abandoned. And it was like, hey, well, I got to build a farmhouse. Let me go grab some stones from that wall over there. So it's not really until you get to the central part of the walk that you really start to see a consistent amount of Roman ruins.
Okay.
But on either side, it's a very pretty walk through British countryside with occasional glimpses of a Roman stone or a little bit of wall here or there. And the other thing you will see, because the wall itself is only part of the Roman fortification, there were ditches on either side that were dug. And so there's definitely that in the middle of fields. You see these sheep kind of walking up and down on these what look like strange little furrows in the middle of a field. And that's because it's the remains of the Roman vallum or valley or ditch that went alongside the wall. So you'll see that as well. But then once you get toward the center part, you're literally walking right along the wall. And there may be parts near a river where you'll see either the remains of a bridge or a whole part of a bridge. And then you will see periodically, you'll see forts that have, some of them have museums in them or attached to them. So they're nice places to stop. Again, these mile castles, which were the ports of entry that you can stop and see. So you see a lot of that stuff.
Is it useful at all to break this down day by day and summarize kind of the 10 days and what you did?
I could. I think probably the best way is really just to say that, kind of break it down by thirds.
Okay.
More like that. Like the first third, we first started out, the westernmost part is a place called Bowness on Solway. And that's right near the River Solway, which is, forms the northern end of the British Empire, or England, excuse me, not the British Empire, on the western side. So if you're walking along the mouth of this river just before it opens out into the Irish Sea, and it's really very pretty, it's very flat, and when you look north across it, you're looking at Scotland. And you spend the first day doing that. You end up in the city of Carlisle, which is a small city in the north of England, which is a really nice little city. There's a castle there that was built in the 1200s. And one of those things where there aren't a lot of stones left from the wall, because most of the stones went to build Carlisle Castle 1,000 years later. So you see that. Again, you're still in this fairly flat area along this river. So that was the first day. I guess I ended up describing the first day. And then the second day we kind of got to, went another 12 miles or so. We were now about 25 miles into the walk. So we were kind of had finished the first half. Again, a lot of walking through fields, very pretty, along country lanes, little hamlets or villages where you've got a cluster of 3 or 4 houses. And at that second day, we actually stopped. That was the first time we stopped for an overnight, where we stayed in one place for the next day, because there was, in this place we stayed was a town of, it was called Lanercost. Lanercost. And there's an historic priory there. It was one of the priories that was deaccessioned. It was a Catholic monastery and priory that was deaccessioned when Henry VIII kind of abolished all of that during his tenure. And so it's the remains of this really beautiful old abbey. And there's a little village that's built up around it. And again, a lot of the stones that were used in it came from the Roman wall. So you can kind of tour it and see it. And so we spent the day doing that. That was one of our non-wall walking days. And of course, because it's England and there are pubs and little tea shops everywhere, there's always a great place to stop for a bite to eat, or in our case, a cup of tea and a really good piece of cake. So you know, we spent the day doing that.
Guilt-free cake, we should point out here, since you're walking all day.
Yes, of course. You know, when you're walking 8 miles or 10 miles, like, I can have another piece of cake.
Well, and would there be enough places that you weren't packing a lunch, just snacks, and were planning on running into a pub or...
And interesting that you asked. Yes, there were for the most part. And we could have also, the B&Bs that we stayed at offered a packed lunch for purchase if we wanted them. What we discovered is that we actually didn't like stopping for lunch. The first day or so we did. And what we realized was...
You lost all your momentum.
Exactly. And it was really difficult to get moving again. So after the first 2 days, we realized that if we stopped, we brought more snacks with us rather than lunch itself. And we would have kind of eat a later breakfast, a pretty full, you know, full English breakfast at our B&B. And then we'd get started and we would have some snacks and maybe stop for about 10 minutes and just kind of rest. And then we did that a few times during the course of the walk. And then we would finish up mid to late afternoon, ideally in time to go have tea somewhere with some scones. And we found that that worked better for us than stopping for lunch. But then once we got to the center part of the wall, that was really where you started seeing the Roman stuff in earnest. It got pretty hilly. You started doing a lot of hill climbing. And again, I mentioned that the overall height, I think the maximum height, there's one spot where you hit the high point of the wall. It's about 1,135 feet, I think, above sea level, which for somebody who's hiked altitudes or done mountain hiking or whatever, they're going to say, well, that's not very high. And that's true. But the fact that you might have climbed 400 feet and then went back down 400 feet, then went up 600 feet and then down, over the course of a day, you might have climbed 3,000 or 4,000 feet, just because there's a lot of roller coaster hiking toward the center portion of that wall walk. In fact, some parts of it, there are actually steps in the hills. So that kind of gives you an indication of how steep they are. And as I mentioned, there are a few forts that are along the way. So you can stop at these forts that have now been turned into museums. They're run by, I think, English Heritage, which is one of the British historic organizations. And they're interesting. I think we went in the first two. There's usually like a little museum or interpretive center there, as well as the ruins of the fort that are nearby. The museums, after a while, take on a certain sameness. Not that they're necessarily bad. It's just that I think they're each geared as though this is the only museum somebody
sees. Sure. You know, okay.
So if you're somebody who's just driving through the area and you want to see a museum and learn about the Hadrian's Wall and what was going on with the Romans in the early part of the first millennium, then that's great. And it's interesting the first time you do it. After you see it a little bit more, you start to realize, okay, the interpretive center is going to be very similar to the one I saw 15 miles west of here. What's unique about this particular fort or museum that I want to see? And that's what we realized as we went through. So some just have more, they just have some unique features. One has a particularly well laid out, almost like a floor plan, because the walls are all but gone, but the foundations remain at this one fort of Burd Oswald. And so you could really see the way the fort was laid out. Another one didn't necessarily have that layout, the Chester's Fort, but it was built down near a river and some of the baths were still evident. Okay. And so you got to see a little bit, you know, a few different things. Those are some of the things you see along the way. The second day that we took to take a break from the walk itself was right about near the midpoint. And that was so that we could visit a site known as Vindolanda, which is a museum and an ongoing Roman excavation. It was a Roman town that existed prior to the building of Hadrian's Wall. So it had been around since about the first century, perhaps 100 or so years earlier. It's a really wonderful site. There's ongoing excavations. There are actually some lay people can kind of volunteer to participate in the ongoing excavation. So you can kind of see what this ancient Roman town looked like. Plus, there's a museum that's attached to it that has some phenomenal collections of artifacts there. There's something about the way that that site had been preserved by nature that yielded up some fantastic artifacts. A lot of things were covered over in a certain type of mud. I don't remember the exact type of soil and stuff, but what it did was it kept oxygen away from a lot of the artifacts.
Okay.
So when they excavated them, they were able to find a lot of soft goods that they normally don't see. So the museum has, for instance, a fantastic collection of leather sandals and shoes that normally would have deteriorated after almost 2,000 years, but they're fully intact. There's even some cloth there. They found some interpretive tablets. They call them postcards, but it has some Roman writing, which kind of detailed, I think they were written on wood, kind of details what Roman life was like during that time. So it's actually considered by scholars to be one of the most important Roman excavation sites in all of Europe, which I think is saying something considering there's a boatload of stuff in Italy itself.
Right, sure.
So it was a place that was definitely worth taking a day off from the walk to spend time seeing. So that was really, really fascinating. So that was our kind of walk through the central portion of the walk. And after visiting Vindolanda, we were kind of getting more toward the third third of our walk. We were getting pretty far east. And the ground was moving back to more rolling hills gradually, losing a lot of the wall remnants, leaving them behind, and getting back through walking through some beautiful British countryside or English countryside, but not a lot in the historic aspect of things. Our very last day, we literally walked right through the city of Newcastle in the north of England, which goes right along the River Tyne. You literally walk along the river, walk right through the center of town before getting to the end of the walk, which is on the eastern end of Newcastle. And there's also a Roman fort there, one of the four forts that is situated along the Hadrian's Wall path. And again, because it was interesting, but because we had seen three other forts and a Roman excavation and a few other museums along the way, by the time we got to that very last fort, there wasn't a whole lot new to see. It was interesting to look at and everything, but it was, okay, how is this one different from the other ones? And had we gone the other way, I'm sure our feelings would have been different.
Sure.
We would have spent a lot of time looking at all the interpretive exhibits. And by the time we got west, we wouldn't have spent as much time on some of those western forts. So that's not quite a day-by-day approach, but a little bit of it. And then the other thing that I would mention, there are a few little, really unique little bits that you find. They're just like sort of bits of Roman remnants as you walk along in various fields. But there was one place where we were just kind of walking along a field, sort of near the central part of it, where we're walking through a farm because it is Britain and walkways are public paths.
Right.
So we're walking through a farm and the farmer had put a big fence, like a square, is about 12 feet square, right in the middle of his field. You could see he was plowing around it. It was an archway that had somebody had excavated and it was just sitting there in the field. It was part of, over time, the soil had built up around, but he clearly, you know, preserved it. And I don't know whether the heritage people helped him or what, but there it is. It's just in a farmer's field. It's this incredibly wonderful little Roman archway. It's about, I don't know, about 8 feet wide and arched about 3 feet above the surface of the ground. And there it was. And so that was pretty cool. And then at another spot, we saw the ruins, remains of a Mithraic temple with some plinths in there. So you just kind of, again, walking through and there's the sheep just sort of placidly grazing amidst all this stuff. But it was just, to me, it was really remarkable to see all these things, almost tripping upon them. It was really very cool to do that.
Was the walk similar to your expectations?
Yeah, I think it was. I would say that one of the things that I was really looking for was to see lots of Roman ruins, and I did, and I thought that was really cool. The other thing that I was hoping for and was pleased to see was that it wasn't super crowded.
Okay.
I was not interested in doing something where it was going to be six people abreast and 20 people behind me and 20 people in front of me. And
right.
I know that there's some other well-known walks that are known for being pretty crowded. This was not. We probably encountered over the course of some of the busier days, we might have encountered 20 or 30 people going the opposite direction and maybe a couple of people passing us or us passing them in the same direction over the course of the day. But it was not crowded at all. So you had plenty of time to just sort of absorb the moment and really just kind of be in the moment, be really mindful of where you were. And I think that was something that really was pleasant for me. One thing that was an especially pleasant surprise, and I couldn't promise this to anybody, but we figured we were going to be walking in the north of England. We did this walk in late spring. It was late May when we did this. We figured it's England. It's going to be raining at least half the time. And we only had 1.5 days of rain in the entire 10 days we were on the walk, which was fantastic. It was wonderful. The scenery was magnificent. The vistas were great. The skies were beautiful blue. I was a little ticked off because I was dragging along my rain gear in my back, my day pack every day, but I'd rather have that than the alternative. You
right.
know, it was kind of funny. It was almost perverse. This one day we woke up and it was pretty much of a driving rain. And we both said, yay, we get to wear our rain gear. You know, we brought it with us from the States. At least we could put on our rain pants and our rain ponchos and stuff. But other than that, we had really great weather, and that was really a very pleasant surprise. So I would say that that was the thing that exceeded my expectation.
Excellent. Anything else that people should know if they want to do this trip?
I think what I would suggest is making sure, because it's a little taxing, unless you're somebody who has walked long distances before, you really need to make sure that you're in practice doing long distances. Michael and I kind of went into, quote, training of sorts prior to this. I had done a few long walks, but never 10-mile walks 8 days in a row or whatever. So we did try and do that a few times while we were getting ready for this. So I would say you really need to be prepared that way. Make sure that your hiking boots or shoes are broken in. Bring enough in the way of rain gear so that if you do have bad weather, you can deal with it, because there's nothing would be more miserable than having to slog through one of these fields knowing that your bed and breakfast is 3 or 4 miles down the road, but you have to slosh through a field full of mud before you get there. So I would say that those are some of the things I would say. And I really do recommend booking it before you go, because I think that there are some places that you could potentially perhaps book a day ahead or just hope you get into a town right. and book in. But the one thing you don't want to do, again, after walking for 8 or 10 miles, is get to a little village or something and discover that there's no room at the inn. And that would be a real drag, I think. So that's where I think that booking ahead helps. And the other thing that I will mention, which is part of the whole idea of booking ahead and using a company to help you book, there's plenty of lodging in the area, or not plenty. There's sufficient for the amount of people that come through, but not every place is right along the walk.
Sure.
Because it's part of it goes through national park. There just might be in a village that's a mile down the road or something. And so you need to make sure that if you've booked someplace, a lot of places that if they're more than a mile or so off of the walk, they'll offer to shuttle over and pick you up, or there are different mechanisms you can use to, you can hire their little cars and little buses on different spots that could take you to your lodging. But if you don't really know where you're going to stay, then that's just something I just can't imagine how cranky I would be after a 10-mile walk, not necessarily knowing the answer to any of that stuff. So that would be my advice there.
Excellent. Well, as we start to wrap this up, you're mm-hmm. standing on the prettiest spot on this walk. Where are you standing? What are you looking at?
You're probably standing at the high point, actually, okay. of the walk, which is at a place called Windshields Crag, which is just about the center of the walk. It's like milepost. If it were a milepost, it's right about 42 miles or so. It's about 1,135 feet high. There's a stone plinth there that you can pose at. But what you have is just this 365-degree view. As you look south toward England, you see this beautiful bucolic farmland, rolling hills, occasionally dotted with occasional farmhouse. It almost looks like a quilt, patchwork quilt laying before you. In the opposite direction, when you look north, You're at the top of a crag, so there's this bluff that you're on top of. You're looking north toward in the direction of Scotland. The terrain shifts very obviously because, and part of it has to do with this crag that you're on top of. There was a geological shift at some point millions of years ago. The topography changes. It's very stark. Not a lot of trees, very kind of rugged, barren countryside, beautiful, but in a rugged, barren sort of way. So that's yet kind of like your north-south view. And then when you look east and west, you see this wall, which is just, it looks like this giant gray caterpillar just sort of undulating up and down over the hills in the distance to the horizon, as far as the eye can see in either direction. And it's pretty remarkable to look back from the direction you've come and say, wow, I just did all of that. Look at how magnificent that is. It just kind of goes on. And you can kind of almost imagine that what was it like for a Roman soldier almost 2,000 years ago? And it's just, you kind of look down at your feet and thank modern technology for your modern hiking boots. You don't have to wear those leather sandals, but it's just a pretty magnificent view. I found it breathtaking.
Excellent.
So I would say that was the pinch me moment.
One thing that makes you laugh about the whole experience.
The fact that I really need, by the time I was halfway through the walk, that I had learned to dodge the sheep droppings because early on I hadn't learned to do that. And that's pretty slippery. And when your keister ends up in sheep poop pretty early on, you think to yourself, this is not really the glamorous trip I had in mind. Fortunately, I was wearing hiking pants that rinse out easily in the sink. So that night, you know, it's like quick dry pants. So there's my other bit of advice. Make sure you wear some quick dry hiking pants. But yeah, that was probably the thing that made me laugh the most once I had it all cleaned off. At the moment, that very moment, I wasn't laughing so hard. But.
And if you had to summarize the experience of hiking Hadrian's Wall in three words, what three words would you use?
Worth the trip.
Excellent. Excellent. Our guest again has been Larissa Milne. Now, Larissa, do you have a blog post on, we didn't say your website when you came on, and I apologize. You want to tell us your website and do you have a post on this particular trip?
Yes. Our blog is called Changes in Longitude, which is just like it sounds, changesinlongitude.com. And there is you can just do a search on it for Hadrian's Wall, and there's or a couple of posts, I think, on there.
And I'll link to that from the show notes as well. And you also got a new blog, we should say, that you're just making now on Arizona, which, why don't you give us that URL also?
ArizonaJourney.org, O-R-G.
Where I suspect I will find nothing about Hadrian's Wall.
Nothing about Hadrian's Wall, but I'll see if I can get it in there so I can link back to my other blog. Yeah. Yeah, so that's a new one. So there's not a whole lot on there yet. Watch that space because more will be there soon.
And Larissa, thanks so much for coming back on Amateur Traveler and telling us about your experience hiking Hadrian's Wall.
Thank you, Chris. Happy to be here. And if anybody has any further questions, if they want to post them either to your site or on our blog, I'd be happy to answer more specific questions.
Thanks so much.
Okay, bye.
First in news of the community, thanks go out to the patrons of the show who help support the show, things like editing and that cost money. And you can also support the show by going to patreon.com/amateurtraveler. I heard this week from Aaron, who had a bone to pick with the episode we did recently in Houston. He said a better side trip besides Galveston would be Washington on the Brazos State Park, only an hour northwest of Houston. It's where the Texas Declaration of Independence was signed in 1836. This location also has a living history farm with staff in period costume performing day-to-day tasks on an 1800s Texas farm. Aaron, thanks so much. That is good to know. And I also heard from Kathy, who commented on the episode we did on Newfoundland way, way back, who said, I'm a Canadian and Newfoundland is my favorite part of Canada. My mother was from there and I have been there every year for the past 5 years. What I love most about this province are the people. They are the friendliest people you will ever meet. It has a quaint beauty that you can't find anywhere else. And Kathy, thank you so much. In news of the amateur traveler trips, we have in fact canceled the trip to Turkey in 2021. I did a poll on the amateurtraveler.com/trips group, And very, very few people said they were ready to travel. And so we're going to put that on hold for a year. We'll talk about where to go next in late summer, probably in August. With that, we're going to end this episode of Amateur Traveler. If you have any questions, send an email to host@amateurtraveler.com, or better yet, leave a comment on this episode at amateurtraveler.com like Kathy and Aaron did. And as always, thanks so much for listening.